We'll hear argument now, number 92-259, the Oklahoma Tax Commission versus the SAC and Fox Nation. Mr. Miley.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This case involves whether the state of Oklahoma may tax the income of a tribal member who is employed by the tribe, the SAC and Fox Nation, and whether Oklahoma may impose motor vehicle taxes on automobiles owned by tribal members of the SAC and Fox Nation. The SAC and Fox Nation imposes its own income and motor vehicle taxes as the state does. The lower courts have enjoined the Oklahoma from collecting these taxes, and the state feels that this injunction is improper for two reasons. There is no federal law which preempts state law in this area, and the state law...
This involves state taxation of tribal members.
This involves state taxation of tribal members, yes.
Who are living where?
Some of the tribal members live on Indian country and some do not live on Indian country.
But it involves all of those members.
All tribal members. We were enjoined from taxing all tribal members who work for the tribe or any tribal members who properly license their car with the tribe. And those tribal members, some live off the Indian country and some live on Indian country. Of course, we have a situation where Indian country is scattered among small plots in an area that is otherwise under state jurisdiction.
What are you including in the term Indian country when you refer to it?
That would be trust land. That is land that is held in trust by the United States of America for the benefit of the tribe itself or for the benefit of an Indian... An individual person.
Are all of the... so-called allotted lands here, lands that are held in trust by the government for tribal members?
Yes, they would be, or they'd be held under an allotment deed, but the allotment deeds are quite old. But mainly we're talking about trust land, but we are talking about allotted land also in this area.
If it's allotted, deeded, and not held in trust, do you count that as Indian country as well?
Yes, under the federal definition, under the federal statute, section 18 U.S.C. section 1151C, that land, an Indian allotment, is included in the term.
But that's as long as the
government holds tax.
That's as long as the...
The government.
If it's been transferred to a non-Indian.
Now, that's true. It could be an original allottee may have transferred that, or it may have been devised to a non-Indian.
So that's
BIA.
That's not Indian country then?
Correct.
So it still has to be in the hands of a member?
Correct. And it has to be, most of the land we're talking about is held in trust by the United States government.
What if the government has conveyed the patent to the allottee, but the allottee is an Indian? Is that land still Indian country?
Well, if the Indian tribal member owns fee land, just the fee title to the land, and there is no trust or restricted status to the land, then that would not be Indian country, just because an Indian would own it.
So when you refer to Indian country, you are not referring to fee lands owned outright by individual Indians?
Correct, and even fee lands that are owned by the tribe itself would not be Indian country. That land would have to be accepted into trust by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Many times, and tribes do in Oklahoma, acquire parcels of land and hold it in fee. The BIA has complete discretion whether to accept that land into trust if the tribe requests it. Sometimes the BIA accepts it into trust, and sometimes the BIA does not. So it must be held in trust to be Indian country.
If you should lose with respect to Indians who are living on trust lands, should you also lose with respect to those who are not living on trust lands? And if the answer is no, why is the distinction important?
Well, I don't think the distinction, we can make a distinction, but if I lose with respect to the Indians on the trust lands, that would have to be because they are within some sort of tribal jurisdiction that is exclusive of state jurisdiction, so that outside of that territory on non-Indian country lands, then the state of Oklahoma would have complete jurisdiction over that individual. And we're talking about the taxation of an individual person, not the
So you're saying the criterion strictly is a territorial jurisdiction criterion, and therefore you would not have to lose with respect to those not on the trust land.
Correct. But
is there any other competing theory of jurisdiction?
Well, here the tribe does not have exclusive jurisdiction, because I think we've got to look at the federal statute, the relevant federal statute, so that in this case, even on Indian country, within Oklahoma, individuals living on Indian country are taxable by the state in Oklahoma. Now, that is because the allotment agreement, if we, for instance, the McClanahan case set up the idea that that case dealt with the Navajo Reservation in Arizona, and that Navajo Reservation was set up exclusively for the tribe, and the tribe was allowed to exclude non-Indians or impose conditions on those that were allowed to enter. Here, the Sac and Fox Nation did have a reservation which was established about the same time, in the 1867, about the same time the Navajo Reservation was established. However, in 1891, the federal government, Congress, passed the allotment agreement or enacted the allotment agreement, which allotted all the lands of the reservation to the tribal members at that time.
Now, or the tribe?
The tribe got about 800 acres.
Yes, all right. Go ahead.
This was a fairly large reservation in central Oklahoma, but even giving acreage to the tribe, even giving a quarter section to each tribal member, they had huge amounts of land left over. And they opened that up, President Harrison opened that up to the legendary land runs, and all people of all kinds came in and took the land, and the tribe was not allowed to exclude those or impose any conditions on them. And so implicit in the terms of that allotment agreement, the relevant statute in this case, we find that the tribe has lost the autonomy that the Navajo Nation had.
Now you say this case only concerns Indians that are living on trust lands?
Well, it concerns
in terms of what the state is. You think that if they're living off of trust lands, the state may impose taxes?
Correct. These are tribal members who work for the tribe. Now, I think many tribal members don't work for the tribe.
Right.
They work for various places, and they there is no argument that they're taxable. But here we have tribal members
who are not living on trust lands, who are working for the tribe.
Who are working for the tribe. And some...
And they are at issue here.
They are at issue, because the lower courts held that if the Indian or if the tribal member works for the tribe, they do not owe taxes, period.
Now, what about tribal members who do not live on trust land, but who are working for the tribe? But you run into the same problem about the automobile tax?
Right. That's correct.
You do?
That's correct. The way the tribal scheme is set up, you don't even have to be a tribal member to get a tribal tag, necessarily.
Oh, I know.
The tribal
unless
members.
You're a tribal member, you're a tribal member, the state has no barrier to insisting on their paying the excise tax.
Right. Yeah. In terms of our own taxes, we feel that even though you pay tribal taxes in either instance, you owe the state taxes also. We're talking about the tribal members on Indian country and off that are tagging their cars with the tribe.
What is the significance of, as to the first tax, the income tax, why is it significant that the Indian who is living on the trust land works for the tribe? What if the Indian doesn't work for the tribe, works for somebody else on the trust land? Is there any contention that Indian does not owe income tax?
Well, I think this case started out much broader, and that the tribe would argue that would be the case.
Yes, I thought that.
I would argue that and the Tenth Circuit did not see it so broadly. They felt that in order, in this circumstance, where we do not have this exclusive type statute, that the fact that they were working for the tribe was the deciding factor as to whether they were taxable or not, because our tax somehow infringed on tribal self-government.
It seems to me that the theory of getting off is either a tribal self-government theory, in which case you ought to get off whether you're on or off trust land, so long as you're working for the tribe. Or else the theory is a territorial theory, in which case you ought to get off so long as you're living on trust land, whether or not you're working for the tribe.
Okay, but this case does not fall very neatly into the on-off dichotomy, because people are constantly going on and off the Indian country, because you cannot conduct your daily affairs of life in Oklahoma on strictly Indian country. You have got to proceed outside of Indian country to do that, because you've got 160 acres of Indian country here and 160 acres down the road. And so if you're living on Indian country, you're necessarily going to have to go off to take care of any business. So you have, what we have here is a situation where Indians are going off Indian country to work and to shop, and what the tribe is saying in this instance is, well, if they work for us, they don't owe any taxes, and if they happen to buy something that they're going to take back to Indian country, like a car, then they don't owe taxes either. Well, that...
But what about, what does the tribe say about people who don't work for the tribe, but who live on Indian country and go off and buy an automobile?
Well, they would say that just because they live on Indian country, they're within the tribal jurisdiction, you see, and that they would not be responsible.
Well, how about on income tax?
An income tax.
Do they claim that Indians who live on trust lands, but who don't work for the tribe but live off of trust lands, away from trust land, do they claim that the state may not tax those Indians? Income tax those Indians?
Okay, now income for a person who, a tribal member who lives off of Indian country.
Yeah, who lives on trust lands, but works off of trust land.
Works off of trust
land. And not for the tribe.
Not for the tribe. Okay, they would argue that because the person lives on Indian country, that would be exempt from state taxation.
Is that at issue in this case?
Well, no, the Tenth Circuit ruled that only those tribal members who worked for the tribe were eligible for this exemption in this case, because I believe they are having a little trouble with the fact that we can't find an existing reservation here. For instance, in the McClanahan case, the tribal member did not work for the tribe in that case. She lived on the reservation, she worked on the reservation, she earned all of her income on the reservation. And because the federal government, in their statute that created the Navajo Reservation, granted the tribe the exclusive jurisdiction over that land, the state was not allowed to come in and tax her. Well, the Tenth Circuit couldn't quite get there with that case, because we have the situation of the allotment agreement.
Well, under McClanahan, what if that person who lived on the reservation, the Navajo Reservation, earned his or her income off the reservation?
Off the reservation, I believe it's in Arizona, they would pay the state income taxes.
Well, did McClanahan hold that, or another case?
McClanahan did not.
Yes.
Did not hold that.
Some other case? If some other case did, I would think it would control. Control the issue in this case of Indians who lived on trust land, but who earned their income off trust land.
Well, I can't think of a case right offhand that does that.
Go ahead.
But in terms of the income tax here, I believe this court has already ruled, the Supreme Court has ruled in the 1930s that in the case of Leahy versus State Treasurer, which relied on Shoto versus Burnett, where you had the situation of an Indian, an Osage Indian who lived on Indian country and earned income from the tribal mineral resources, and he was taxable on the income that he earned on those tribal mineral resources. In that case, because there was not this type of reservation that you have in the Navajo cases, and then coming a few years later in Oklahoma Tax Commission versus U.S., the Supreme Court also ruled that members of the five civilized tribes would owe Oklahoma estate taxes on their estates, which included Indian country, where they live, their homestead allotments.
Just one more question on this preliminary part of your argument. If we rule for you,
pardon me, if we rule against you on your point, does the case still have to go back to determine whether or not you have jurisdiction to tax people that are in Indian country? Or do we have to, we can remand for that, can't we?
Well, I don't...
I mean, because if you don't have civil or criminal jurisdiction over Indian country, which yes. I take it you don't, and McClanahan no. says that no. that's the key for taxation, and if the Tenth Circuit didn't reach that, we don't necessarily have to reach that issue in this case, do we? We can remand.
Well, I don't think I agree with your reasoning that you've got to have civil and criminal jurisdiction. I think the whole basis of the McClanahan case was that the Navajo Treaty preempted state law. And yeah. so in this case, we have an allotment agreement that did away with that exclusive treaty and implies that state law now applies. And we have cases, Supreme Court cases, that suggest that I believe are applicable to this situation that conclude that state law, state tax law does apply for an individual's income.
All right, so you think we should resolve that issue here in this case?
Yes, I do. Right. I think, though, that one of the things that the lower courts declined to do was resolve the reservation issue of to what extent the reservation exists, and I believe that is a necessary part of a finding in this case. I believe that in order to reach the conclusion, if in fact state law infringes on tribal self-government, you've got to find the reservation where it is acting on, and I think you'd have to have an exclusive reservation in order to, if in fact the state law will be an infringement on the tribal government in this case. And I don't think that was what Congress intended when they passed the allotment agreement. I think we've got to give the allotment agreement as broad a sweep as the Congress intended that passed the act. And in that case, they were terminating the reservations in the state of Oklahoma to, in fact, create the state. And I think in reading the accounts in the case of the case that I cited, Woodward versus DeGraffenreid,
Escalero case. Escalero held that if a tribe sets up a business off the reservation, it's subject to the state gross receipts tax.
Correct. And do
you suppose that would cover? That would control a case of an individual Indian working off the reservation and earning income?
Well, that's correct. It would. And I think that case did rely on the earlier Oklahoma cases to some extent. The Mescalero case, however, dealt with a tribe off of a reservation.
Yes. Well, talking about
an individual
Indian, and certainly the tribe is located on the reservation.
On the reservation.
An individual Indian living on the reservation goes off the reservation. That's his and his regular workplace where he earns income is not on the reservation.
Correct. So in that case, is as well as earlier cases like Ward versus Racehorse hold that when Indians leave Indian country, they're subject to state law as all other persons are.
What does it mean? If working for the tribe was a big factor in the decision below, which you think it was,
yes.
What does it mean working for the tribe in terms of residence? To work for the tribe, do they have to work on Indian country?
Well, in this case, the headquarters building is on Indian country.
Well, I know that, but are those the only people who can be said to be working for the tribe?
I believe some employees would probably perform some duties off of Indian country in this case. There could be a situation where you'd have an employee that would be working off of Indian country for the tribe. Most definitely.
What do you understand the Leahy case to stand for?
Well, in that case, I believe it stands for the fact that when Indians within Oklahoma The tribes do not have the autonomy that reservation tribes in other states do. And I think the court in that case was recognizing the fact that Indian governments do exist in Oklahoma. Indian country does exist in Oklahoma, but that's not the determining factor. That's not what we're trying to determine here. We're trying to determine how Congress treated these tribes. They did not give these tribes the exclusive autonomous situation that they gave the Navajos.
Did you cite Lay to the Tenth Circuit?
Yes, I did.
And how did they deal with it at all in their
opinion? They did not deal with it in their opinion. I believe it is fairly much squarely opposed to their opinion, in my view. So they instead relied on the later case of McClanahan to support their position. But I think the problem with relying on the McClanahan case is that they quoted the language in McClanahan that said the federal statute the federal statute requires that the state law be excluded in this area, and the Tenth Circuit did not point to any federal statute that excludes law for Oklahoma in regards to the Second Fox Nation. I think that relevant statute is the allotment agreement, and it does nothing in that allotment agreement would presume to exclude state law. I think it was the intent of that agreement to terminate the reservations and to include state law.
Don't you think the tribe on the 800 acres that it was allotted and it's held in trust by the United States?
Yes.
Don't you think the tribe can control who is permitted to enter that piece of trust land?
As much as any private landowner would, yes.
Well, that's pretty big, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
They can put up a fence around the whole thing, can't they?
Right.
And so isn't it dedicated to their exclusive use?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But...
So how does that differ from the notion that some person who lives and works and earns money on the Navajo reservation is not subject to state income tax?
Well, the federal statute that allotted the land to the tribe in this case did not provide that there would be any type of exclusive jurisdiction for this tribe.
Well, it may not, but you just said that the tribe has complete control of this land and can keep people off of it.
Well, I...
So where did that come from?
Well...
It doesn't come from state law, apparently.
No, it came
comes from federal law.
Federal law, yes.
Well, then, maybe the Allotment Act didn't expressly provide for it, but somewhere out of the atmosphere, you say federal law gives the tribe complete control of that land, that 800 acres.
Yes, that 800 acres subject to the, BIA's oversight.
I thought you said the tribe had the same rights as a private property owner would have.
Correct.
Well, that would suggest state law, wouldn't it?
No. With this Indian country, they would be subject to the BIA's oversight as far as what they want to do with the land. Certainly, they would have to get approval for those types of things. So it is kind of in that sense that it would be under more federal jurisdiction, I believe.
Well, the only difference between the Navajo reservation example I just gave you and this is that it's very likely that most of the Indians, or is it very likely that most of the Indians who work for the tribe on their 800 acres do not live on the 800 acres?
Most likely they do not.
They do not.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miley. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Kneedler.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. There are two possible theories of immunity from state taxation at issue in this case, and they were the ones identified.
Well, could I ask you just at the outset, do you support and defend the decision of the Tenth Circuit?
Not in its entirety, Justice White.
I didn't think so.
No.
So go ahead.
Yes. We there are two possible theories. On one of them, the territorial theory, essentially the principle synthesized by this court in McClanahan, we think the court was mistaken. The Court of Appeals seemed to believe that it was sufficient if the Indian earns his income within Indian country, irrespective of where he resides. In McClanahan itself, however, the Indian both lived and worked on the Indian reservation. It's common for states, and Oklahoma is one of these states, to tax income on the basis of either where the individual resides or works. And as long as that statute is applied in an even-handed manner, the territorial principle of McClanahan would not bar the tax if the individual either resided or worked off the reservation. We do think it's significant, however, that Oklahoma affords a credit to a resident who works in another state, but does not afford a comparable credit to a resident who works for the Indian tribe. So in the example of someone who, an Indian who lives off the reservation but works on the reservation, we would think a parallel to Oklahoma's own state taxing scheme would suggest that a credit might be given, and that is, we think, something that could be decided on remand. But because the Court of Appeals...
Mr. Needler, is that something that has been ruled upon, or is that just practice that you're referring to?
It's Oklahoma's own tax code provides that, and the amicus brief filed in this case by a number of states identifies that as a common practice.
But it's never... You don't know of any case that says that Oklahoma automatically does that for the person who is taxed by an Indian tribe.
Oklahoma does not do that for an Indian tribe, and we think this case should be remanded because a necessary aspect of the McClanahan analysis is where the individual resides and works. We think the case should be remanded insofar as the McClanahan analysis is concerned to determine exactly where the tribal employees do live and work. We assume that most of the tribal employees work in Indian country, but
what's your view if they don't?
If they
don't live on they work for the tribe on Indian country, but they live off of it. What's your view?
In that event, we believe the state could tax them, although we think on remand the court could examine this question of whether credit should be given for the income tax paid
exactly
to the tribe.
On what basis? Equal protection? Is that it or what?
I think Indian law principles and the Indian Commerce Clause, I think there's a relative balancing of the state tribal interests in a situation like this. And in a situation like this, where the individuals are employed by the tribe itself.
It seems to me, Mr. Needler, in that case, the tribe could tax them 100% and then get 100% deduction from there, because they all work for the tribe, so the income is paid by the tribe to them, then take some of it back in the form of taxes. Could they just tax 100% and then say that we want a credit from a state income?
Well, I think there may be some resistance on the part of the political process within the tribe, I think, would limit the amount of tax in that.
But you wouldn't say the state had to give that kind of a credit under federal law.
I think there's a substantial argument that it should, given its tax structure with respect to off-reservation. But I think one of the things the court should examine is the extent to which the failure to give that credit would interfere with tribal self-government.
In any of our recent cases, have we said there was a dormant Indian Commerce Clause?
The court has not relied on the Indian Commerce Clause.
Why should we hear?
It's not really necessary to, because we think it's sufficient to look both to the Indian country status of the land at issue, and it is Indian country status, not reservation status, that we think is the starting point of analysis in this case, and look at the question of whether the tribe is, whether there's tribal self-government actually working in the area, whether there's a government-to-government relationship between the United States and the Indian tribe.
You said there were two theories. You've gone over the property.
Right, the territorial-based one.
Yeah, territorial. And what's your...
The second one...
Except your last remarks didn't sound like territorial-based. Your last remarks sound like...
Well, he was getting... They were... Was he getting...
He was
next
getting
one? To it.
Oh, all right. I thought he was mixing the two up there.
On the credit point, I was simply saying that's a common accommodation of states, both of whom have some territorial jurisdiction. And that's what I was suggesting on the credit. On the interference with tribal self-government point, because the individuals here are actually employed by the tribe.
This is
the second theory. Because the individuals here are actually employed by the tribe, there's a substantial argument we think that the income tax would be preempted irrespective of where the individuals live, because any taxes paid by the tribal officers and employees to the state necessarily has an impact on the amount of
money.
Well,
I thought you just said a while ago if the tribal member's living off of is not living on trust land, the state could tax them.
Under the McClanahan territorial theory, what I was suggesting is there may be a separate theory that we think should also be examined on remand because here the individuals are actually employees of the tribe itself.
Mr. Needler, would that theory apply equally to a non-member employed by the tribe?
It might, but we think that the interference with that question is not before because the Tenth Circuit rejected that. But the interference with tribal self-government, we think, would be much more pronounced.
Well, how
the
does it interfere with tribal self-government to have them pay an income tax
to the state?
Well, because just as a matter of economics, we think that in order to compete in the labor market, if the individuals whom the tribe employs have to pay both a state tax and on top of that a tribal tax. The tribe's ability to operate a government in the same way that a local government or a state government would be operated outside the reservation, they would be competitively disadvantaged.
So ruling for the tribe here would enable them to keep a kind of a cheap labor source.
Well, no, they would be. It's simply a question of when the tribe employs its own members, which we think is at the core of tribal self-government.
This business of interference with tribal self-government is sort of common law, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It is. The courts have been making it up, including.
It's a common law against the backdrop of 200 years of this nation's.
Well, I know,
history.
But the courts have been. I don't. Do you read it in some statute?
No, but the.
Well, then it's common law, and the courts have been making it.
Well,
up.
But it goes all the way back to Worcester versus Georgia.
Well, it may be, but that Worcester, that was a court decision.
Yes. But again, when the Indian activity takes place in Indian country, that is the historic touchstone, not reservation. Indian country is the historic touchstone all the way back to the Non-Intercourse Acts of 1790 and 1834, where federal and state law applies and where, federal and tribal law applies and state law does not. And in Worcester versus Georgia, the court said as long as there's a distinct community occupying its own territory, and that here would include the allotments or dependent Indian communities as well as the trust status.
Do you think this second theory would touch upon the automobile excise tax?
No. The automobile excise tax is just the first territorial theory.
So it would just be territorial, but you would say that the state may not put the excise tax on Indians who are living in what kind of a community did you say?
Dependent Indian community.
What is that?
It's one of the three definitions of Indian country under 1151. It covers situations, for example, where there's a housing authority or something set aside by the federal government or by the tribe under federal auspices where Indians reside, but it may not actually be trust land. It may not be on a true reservation. It's a definition that's developed from this court's decision in McGowan and Sandoval.
Mr. Needler, why wouldn't your first theory, your territorial theory, why wouldn't that apply to someone who's not employed by the tribe?
It would. The territorial in McClanahan,
So you're free from income tax whether you're employed by the tribe or not.
Under McClanahan. And we think it's significant that in Dakota, for example, where this court held the reservation was disestablished, the court was at some pains, we think, to show that that would not adversely affect the Indians themselves on Indian country outside the reservation. It said, even with Indian country, which the court pointed out specifically included allotments, a state may have jurisdiction over some persons or types of conduct. This jurisdiction is quite limited. And the court specifically cited McClanahan after that recitation, indicating that the immunity from state taxation should apply, even though the reservation was disestablished, wherever you have Indian country, and thus we think wherever the individual is residing and working within Indian country, as long as there is a functioning tribal government with jurisdiction over that particular land. Here we think that the compact of tribal self-government entered into between the Sac and Fox Nation and the United States demonstrates that tribal self-government, contrary to the view of the state of Oklahoma, is alive and well in the state.
Thank you, Mr. Needler. Mr. Rice, we'll hear now from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, we believe that this case can be resolved by straightforward application of this court's per se rule and the rules of stare decisis. The court has ruled previously in several cases in which the court did not recognize that there was an existing Indian reservation, that state taxes, at least as to tribal members within the Indian country, were not applicable. Those cases include Rickard, the Kansas Indians, the New York Indians, several other cases cited in the brief. Now, the state would have you believe that the tribe here is totally subject to state law, that the Indian reservation of the Sac and Fox Nation was abolished back in 1891, and that the tribe is not a tribe in the normal sense of the word. I don't believe that any of those are true. Now, the per se rule that this court has developed has been applied in the early cases I just mentioned in Montana versus Blackfeet. The court said that the states may tax Indians only when Congress has manifested clearly its consent. That is clearly a different analysis, a different type of rule than the state would bring forward here, where they say the question is not, has Congress said that Oklahoma can tax the tribe? They're trying to advance the theory that the state may tax unless Congress has said they cannot.
Right.
And as that court has simply said, the court has simply said that's
not. Are there prior cases covering the situation about state trying to tax and member of a tribe who does not live in Indian country but works in Indian country?
Your Honor, I don't believe there's anything exactly on
point. What is your position on that?
My position on that is that the line, if you will, or the bright line rule that should be applicable here is the Indian country line. What we have
Indian country, you mean if he's working in Indian country or
yes,
if he's living in Indian
country? If he's working in Indian country. The action of the Indian inside the Indian country should be the determining question.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically the opposite of Mescalero with Apache tribe versus
Does that
Jones.
Cover the automobiles, too?
It covers the individual, for instance, who would go to a automobile dealership and have a car delivered to him and title transferred within the Indian country. That's Central Machinery, first mm-hmm. Arizona Tax Commission. Mm-hmm. That exact thing happened in that case, only it was a tractor dealership who were being taxed mm-hmm. on a gross receipts tax, which is kind of an income tax.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what if the Indian in this particular case lived on non-tribal land, went to an automobile dealer that was on non-tribal land, not Indian country, bought an automobile, and said, I'll take delivery of it at the 800-acre reservation?
I think the answer to that is when he brings that automobile from the reservation or from his allotment back out, let's say, to Norman, outside the Indian reservation, outside the Indian country, at that point, since he's a resident there, he becomes obligated to pay the state tax there. If he bought that piece of property to leave it in the Indian country and, you know, to operate it there, and the good example, the classic example, is the individual who spends the summers in Colorado and works back home during the school year as an educator, for instance. If he leaves all his furniture, his car, et cetera, on his allotment within the Sac and Fox Indian country during the school year, that's between him and the tribe. That's what is set aside by the whole Indian country concept. To the tribe and the federal government. On the other hand, when it comes May and he gets out of school and he flies up to Colorado and picks up that car, now he owes state taxes on that car.
But he could drive his own car up there without being taxed by a state.
He could, sir.
Yeah.
But the key, in your view, is where the person works, not where the person lives?
The key is the conduct of the Indian in the Indian country. The Indian country has always been defined by Congress, by court decision, as that area that's set aside for tribal self-government, for Indian occupancy and Indian use. That's been the theory behind the concept of Indian country from the beginning days.
We have no, but you've got no, we haven't got any square cases on that. Living off the reservation, but working on.
Not to my knowledge.
Yes. The cases you mentioned,
the
Kansas case.
It's the Congress, Mescalero versus Jones.
Who did you mention, the Kansas case? And
the Kansas Indians and the New York Indians. Now, if you say the Indian...
They were living on and working on.
What we had there was a situation where the tribe's reservations had been abolished, apparently.
Right.
And the claim made there was basically the same claim that's being made here. These Indians are assimilated into the state community, and you can't tell the difference and so forth. The court came back and said, no, as long as the political branches of the government, as long as the Congress and the executive recognize these as a people with a tribal government, having the right to make and enforce their own laws and maintaining governmental relationship with the United States, they're outside the authority of the state to levy taxes. Even though their reservation had been abolished,
but they were living in Indian country.
I believe that they were. I mean, that's the outgrowth of those cases. That's why I say I don't know, offhand, of a clear case where an Indian was outside the Indian country and came in and went to work in the Indian country.
And stayed and continued to live off of it.
That's correct.
But your position is that the same rule ought to apply.
My position is the same rule of McClanahan should apply, because what McClanahan, when you get back to page 179 and 180 of the opinion down at the bottom, basically says that this person was an Indian and the income they earned came from the Indian reservation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those are really the two penultimate issues in McClanahan, is the person the Indian and did they earn it in the Indian country?
Yeah, and the territorial rationale doesn't exactly work out, but I suppose you would argue with the federal government that that perhaps it's an interference with tribal self-government.
Insofar as the use of a tax could be used to regulate conduct, I believe, yes, it is.
Are you claiming this exemption not just for income received from the tribe, but any income?
I believe that any income that an Indian earns in the Indian country is exempt from state taxation.
And with respect to the car, I'm not sure whether you said the car. The Indian has to reside in Indian country, and also the car has to be garaged there? Both?
The position is that the property has to be garaged located in the Indian country.
Okay, so what if the Indian lives off of the Indian country, but he garages his car in the Indian country? Is that car exempt from the taxes here?
I believe it would be.
It would be.
Could you give us a citation of the Kansas and New York Indians?
The Kansas Indians, Your Honor, is 72 U.S. 667, and the New York Indians follows that immediately.
Right. It was 72, 767?
72, United States, 667. As previously indicated, the court has adopted a per se rule against the taxation of Indians in the Indian country. I think simple, straightforward application of that rule resolves this case. The per se rule, as it was stated last term in County of Yakima versus Yakima, and as has been stated in California versus Cabazon and Montana versus Blackfeet, is really a penultimate outgrowth of the preemption rule of federal preemption. The problem here is that we're trying to apply the allotment agreement in a vacuum. It's as if the first time there's a relationship between the Sac and Fox Nation and the United States came about in the allotment agreement. That's simply not the case. There's been a treaty relationship between the United States and the Sac and Fox Nation since 1789. The early treaties between the Sac and Fox Nation and the United States are exactly the same type of treaties that Worcester versus Georgia held to preempt all state action by the state of Georgia. Now, the court has gone then from a per se rule to a preemption analysis, and has come back, at least in the tax situations, to a per se rule. The one thing that is happening here that I think is important in this context is the redevelopment or the reaffirmation by Congress, if you will, of the rights to tribal self-government, and I refer specifically to the Sac and Fox Nation self-governance grant and compact that they have entered into now with the United States Department of the Interior.
Mr. Rice, how is this possibly administrable in a state, especially like Oklahoma, where there are just a lot of isolated pockets of Indian territory? Your position is, if the money is earned by an Indian in Indian country, it's exempt from state tax. So what do you do with somebody that drives to work? Let's assume he's a carpenter. He does part of his work on the Indian country, part of his work off of the Indian country. How can you possibly administer a scheme like that? I mean, I can see if you're limiting it to income received from the tribe, you can identify it, but how is Oklahoma going to identify what income is earned on Indian country and what is earned off Indian country? There's a whole, you can see a whole volumes of law being written about this when Indian income is earned.
I don't think it's that difficult to identify what the Indian country is.
Well, that's true.
That's a fairly simple analysis based on 18 U.S.C. 1151. You identify a reservation, a dependent Indian community, or an Indian allotment, and you immediately know where that is.
Right. Okay, but let's assume I'm a delivery. My business is delivering newspapers, and I deliver newspapers to somebody in Indian country. Okay?
Okay.
Part of my delivery is in Indian country, and part of my route is outside of Indian country. What do I do? Divide my salary by two and...
No more than you would if you were selling things inside the state and outside the state, for instance. You would, or the same type of situation occurs when you have taxable income and non-taxable income. You simply report that part that's taxable to the state of Oklahoma, and you report that part that's taxable to the Sac and Fox Nation.
Yeah, I think the situation is a lot rarer in the interstate situation than it is with people living in the state of Oklahoma and driving in and out of Indian country all the time.
Well, it's not really a case, I think, of driving in and out of the Indian country all the time. The more rational situation is going to be where you have a fellow who works all day, for instance, at the tribal office, drives back to an area outside of the Indian country and goes to a second job in the evening as a checker at the grocery store or some other type of employment. I don't think that would be any trouble at all to decide what part of that income goes to state authority and which one doesn't, and that's the straw man, really, is the McClanahan, Rosalind McClanahan, who works for the Navajo Legal Services during the daytime, is not taxable on that income, and yet if she drives over to Gallup off of the reservation and works an evening job, then under the McClanahan rule, I'd presume she's taxable on the income that she earned at Gallup. And that's the case that's going to come up.
Mr. Rice, did I gather you said that the state may not only not tax Indians who live off Indian country and work on Indian country, but they also may not tax non-Indians who live off the Indian country and work on Indian country?
I'm not sure I quite understand.
Well, let's assume there's a non-Indian who lives off the reservation, mm-hmm. or lives off Indian country but works on Indian country. Maybe that's just a figment of maybe that's just him, because it may be that nobody who's a non-Indian ever gets to work on.
No, there are some that work there.
All right, so what's the answer?
Well,
non-Indian living off but working on.
I think there's two answers to that. One is...
You can either say the state may tax him or may not.
Well, I think the state may not tax him for two reasons. Yeah. One is that mm-hmm. as long as he is working for the tribe or engaged in conduct which is subject to regulation, the state interferes by taxing him with tribal self-government to the point that they are trying to use their tax to regulate conduct in a different way.
Did the Tenth Circuit decide against you on that?
No, they did not. They decided that adversely to us.
That's what I said, against you. They decided against you.
Yes.
And we denied cert on
that. You denied cert on that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, that isn't an issue here.
It's not
we
really.
We now know what your position
that's,
is.
That's the position that we have because of the treaties and the other. Now, in addition to the per se rule and the preemption, we also have this stare decisis question. McClanahan squarely holds that Indians, I think, in the Indian country are not subject to state income tax. Moe versus Confederated Salish and Kootenai and Washington versus the Colville tribes provide the same type of background for automobile taxes. The taxes here are property taxes, pure and simple. They're based on the value of the car. The Oklahoma courts, as shown in exhibits 18 and 27 through 32 in the Tenth Circuit exhibits, have ruled against the tax commission on exactly this issue. It was interesting in the Solicitor General's letter lodged with the court that the Oklahoma Court of Appeals has now ruled against the tax commission on the issue of the income tax in Cora versus Oklahoma Tax Commission. But the stare decisis situation here is such that the court all really just needs to simply apply those cases to this situation. Those cases apply in the Indian country, and since they are applicable in the Indian country, in my view, The court need go no further. Now, if the court chooses to take the next step, then the question becomes whether the original boundaries of the Sac and Fox Indian Reservation have been extinguished, and that's an issue that neither the district court nor the Tenth Circuit chose to address. It'd be our position in that case that you could either remand for that decision or you could go ahead and decide it on the record that's here.
Who brought this suit?
Excuse me?
Who brought this suit?
The nation brought this suit, Sac and Fox Nation.
Well, did you, and was part of your claim that the reservation had never been destroyed?
Yes, sir, it was.
Destroyed? And none of the lower courts decided it?
They did not decide that issue at all. The reference is continuously to the abolished reservation or the old reservation or the reservation that's not there anymore. The fact of the matter is no court has ever ruled that way. That was part of the complaint. That was part of the argument all the way up. That was never ruled on. The courts below simply did what we said is the only thing that this court really needs to do, and that was to apply the per se rule and the rules of stare decisis and say that these cases, McClanahan, Moe, Coville, and Central Machinery, apply pure and simple within the Indian country. Because of that, we have Indian country where the tribal trust land is, because all a reservation has ever really been is land that's been set aside under the superintendence of the government for Indians. That's what a reservation turns out to be. We have dependent Indian communities. We have allotments that are still in trust. Because we have that situation, we don't have to decide the reservation boundary issue. We've got the tribe on trust land. We've got most of the people that work there on trust land. And we can let the reservation boundary issue go for
another day. But you lost half your, you lost some of your case in the Tenth Circuit and we denied cert.
Yes, sir.
But it might have come out differently if they had decided that the reservation had not been abolished.
No, I don't think under their analysis that it would have come out any different.
Oh, I see. All right.
Because what they simply said is they drew a distinction between tribal members and non-tribal members.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the basis of the distinction.
Yeah, all right, all right.
It wasn't an Indian country decision.
Could you tell me just a little bit more about the nation itself? This 800 acres, is that trust land, I understand. Trust,
yes, sir.
For the tribe or for individual Indians?
That is, the 800 acres is land which was explicitly reserved out of the operation of the allotment agreement by the agreement itself.
I see.
It was to be held as the tribal land had always been held, in other words, under the 1867 treaty.
It's held by the United States in trust for the tribe.
Yes, sir.
And roughly how big is the nation? How many Indians live on that?
About 2,500 members of the nation.
I see.
Now, they don't all live on the 800 acres.
But some of them live on the
acres. There's a few of them that do, yes. Most of them reside on allotments or around the original reservation area.
What is the 800 acres primarily used for? What is that?
Is where the center of the tribal government is, the tribal administrative offices, everything from the chief's office and residence down to the powwow grounds is on that 800 acres,
and
plus a couple of hundred that's been added to it.
And is there a large number of employees working for the tribal government?
Most of them work there. There's about 90 tribal employees that work right, you know, mostly in that area. Now, that number does not include members of tribal boards, commissions, agencies, and
if we took all of the employees of the tribe together, how many people would be talking about, roughly?
Roughly 140 to 150 people.
Quite a group, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them,
about
if not
70,
all, live on Indian country.
I would say the large majority of those live on Indian country. Now, we are, I suppose, back to the bright line rule. We think that that is what Indian country is the place that Congress has set aside. They've laid the tribe, if you will, behind the log. And they have said in 1151, which basically codified decisions of this court and the understanding that Solicitor Cohen had in his Handbook of Indian Law in 1942, that the Indian country is the place for tribal self-government. It's a place where state law only applies when Congress says that it does. Now, that's been the concept of Indian country. You don't have to decide the reservation boundary issues to decide the case. If you adopt and apply the McClanahan, Moe, Coville series of cases through stare decisis, will do the per se rule. On the other hand, it seems to me that if you do not apply those cases to the Indian country generally, as it's been defined by Congress in 1151, then in order to rule against the tribe on the part of the case on which certiorari was granted, you have to overrule that line of cases, because it's kind of an either-or proposition. If our reservation's there, then those cases ought to apply. If those cases apply to all Indian country, regardless of reservation status, we don't have to get to that issue. But if the reservation is there, then the only way that these cases don't apply would be to overrule.
Yes, but your bright-line rule, I think, is you would cover Indians who live on Indian country and work on Indian country, but it doesn't cover Indian tribal members who don't live in Indian country.
It would seem to me it covers conduct of an Indian in the Indian country.
And well, I know, but none of the cases just clearly cover that, and you indicated that you didn't know of any case that
not
covered it.
Not in the income tax situation.
Yeah,
there are criminal cases, for instance.
Well, I'm talking about talking about income taxes.
Mm-hmm. But your bright line rule, I just want to be sure I understand, would cover the operation of a commercial activity, not just working for the government. If they ran a casino, for example, in Indian country, even though it's not in a reservation, but as long as it's in Indian country, that the bright line rule would protect the income from the casino.
That's exactly right.
Or an oil well or something like that.
That's exactly right. If it's the Indian conduct in the Indian country, then that is what Congress has put behind the law.
But if the tribe is running a business out of in the Indian country, I suppose Mescalero control.
That would be Mescalero. If the tribe chose to take a business 100 miles away from its Indian country, and the United States does not put that in trust or does not otherwise, you know, take action that would make it Indian country, then that's subject to state jurisdiction.
Even if the reservation wasn't formally abolished, all of the land other than that which has been held in trust and allotted to Indians, all of that has already been patented to non-Indians or to somebody else. So it would be, you might say, well, here's where the reservation used to be, but
There's still a real solid Indian presence in that area, and I think we've taken a position in.
Well, I know, but you wouldn't say that you could exclude anybody you wanted to within the bounds of the old reservation now.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that we would exclude the landowners. No, I think that one's solved in Montana versus the United States and a couple other cases here. The difference, though, is the Indian conduct in those areas that have still retained reservation status is Matz versus Arnett. And those cases say that the Indian work, the Indian activity there, their actions, are still within the Indian country. I think I want to make it very clear that our position in the brief and here also is that there's three fallback positions basically on the Indian country issue. One of those is, and the first one, I think, is that the original boundaries are still there. The second one is that regardless, if you read the allotment agreement and the legislative history, which is in the exhibits that were in the Tenth Circuit,
we've got a
diminished one, not a big one.
But if the reservation were still there and was not abolished, you wouldn't say that every acre of ground within the bounds of the reservation would be Indian country?
Yes, sir, it is Indian country because 1151A says that it includes all Indian reservations notwithstanding the issuance of any patent. And Seymour versus Superintendent says a patent to anybody, whether that's a patent to an Indian or a patent to a non-Indian.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.